Hello and welcome back to Current Account. I'm your host, Clay Lowry, the Executive Vice President here at the Institute of International Finance. On Current Account, I try to talk about what I see as the most important current issues in international finance and economics, while providing my own U.S. politics and policy angle on these different issues when it is relevant. On this week's Current Account, we're going to talk about currency, particularly and most specifically, the currency of Japan, which is called the yen. The main reason for that is a few things. One, the yen has just recently hit a 34-year low, so 1990 is what we're talking about, against the dollar. Secondly, there was clearly intervention by the Japanese government to try to appreciate the yen, in other words, to try to make it stronger. So it's become interesting in the markets, and so we want to unpack it a little bit. And to do that, I want to talk to Rebecca Patterson. So Rebecca has been a macro researcher, a trader, and an investor in the United States, Europe, and Asia for more than 25 years. Most recently, she was the chief investment strategist at Bridgewater Associates. And maybe even more importantly or more relevantly for today, she spent her first decade in finance researching currency markets at JP Morgan. She has worked closely with policymakers and corporations on FX issues. You'll hear me say that. That means foreign exchange issues throughout her career. And she served on the New York Federal Reserve's Foreign Exchange Committee and has actually taught foreign exchange courses to central bankers. Anyway, Rebecca is the perfect person to talk about this. And let's start with the yen. So Rebecca, can you just kind of relay what's actually happened?
Sure. So we don't have any official confirmation yet, Clay, but it looks like Japan has conducted at least two rounds of intervention so far this week to strengthen the yen. And we're speaking right now on May 2nd. So we had intervention, we believe, on April 29th and May 1st. We might be having some right now as we speak, and the week's not over. But this happened after dollar yen, the exchange rate touched 160, as you mentioned before. And again, not confirmed, but the reports we're seeing and the data we have suggest that the two rounds of intervention at least cost Japan somewhere between $55 and $60 billion. So that's a lot of capital to move the yen from 160 down to its current level at around 153 and change. So these yen purchases to try to strengthen the yen followed repeated verbal warnings from Japanese policymakers, and really just in the last several days, a surge in the dollar-yen exchange rate from around 155 to 160, so the yen weakening to 160. I've seen a lot of intervention over my career. Clay, I know you have too. And in Japan specifically, there tends to be a bit of a pattern that Japan uses to maximize its investment, if you will. And there's a couple things I'd highlight. First is that they will tend to intervene in periods of lighter liquidity. So if you have less liquidity in the market, it means, in effect, you get more bang for buck on the intervention dollar you spend or buy, depending which way you're going. And so right now in Japan, we have something called the Golden Week holidays. So liquidity conditions are lighter. That means intervention tends to have a relatively bigger impact. So that's part of the reason it's happening now. I'd say second is Japan will often intervene around key market catalysts that could impact the yen and create more currency volatility. Not a surprise to me that intervention occurred just around the latest U.S. Federal Reserve policy decision. And again, I wouldn't be surprised if there is some intervention on Friday, May 3rd, or either before or after the non-farm payroll report. We've seen that pattern before by the Japanese. And then one last point I'd make on the ongoing intervention. It is succeeding so far at stabilizing the yen and strengthening it slightly, but it's probably not going to succeed sustainably changing the currency's trend. And there's a couple reasons for that. First is that the intervention was unilateral. That means Japan acted on its own. Second, it was not backed by other supportive policies. And third, it was occurring in a broadly stronger dollar environment. When you look historically at intervention, it is most effective when it's coordinated. That is, when several countries work together to impact the market. It sends a bigger signal, and there's just more money pushing the market in one direction. And the example I think we probably all learned about in school is the 1985 Plaza Accord. Back then, you had the U.S. and four other countries all acting together to weaken the dollar. So again, today's case, Japan is acting on its own. But the other thing it's not doing yet is taking other steps outside of intervention, which could also help the yen. So in the case of the Plaza Accord, there were other fiscal and monetary acts to weaken the dollar. Today in Japan, what could help strengthen the yen is significantly higher Japanese interest rates. Right now, there's a big difference between the yield you get on a U.S. government bond and a Japanese bond. It's about 400 basis points, 4 percentage points. So the U.S. bond is more attractive. Investors are going to buy dollars to buy those bonds, and that pushes up the dollar and hurts the yen. So could Japan materially lift interest rates? Well, we could talk about this more a little later, but from everything we're hearing from the Bank of Japan, it doesn't seem like that kind of material rise in interest rates is coming anytime soon. I think the last thing I'd say here is we have to remember that in currency markets, the dollar has a very special role. About 90% of all currency trades involve the dollar. So the U.S. is the price setter. All other countries are price takers. So for Japan to have a stronger yen, it really needs to start with the U.S., not Japan. You need a broadly weaker dollar that probably includes lower U.S. interest rates. And we saw from the Fed this week that that might not be happening soon.
That is a great answer, and thank you very much, because it is confusing sometimes, and your point about policies is really important. I used to do currency policy when I was in government, and you know, everybody focuses so much on the currency policy or on the specifics, and sometimes you forget, really, it's about the overall policy environment, fiscal, monetary, sometimes even trade, and just kind of how you do things. All right, so let's focus a little on Japan. You mentioned this a bit. So Japan has been experimenting with monetary policy for at least 10, probably closer to 20 years. We just saw, I think it was in March, I may be off, they moved off of something that's called yield curve control. So is the policies that Japan has been following, is it, you know, some people said, hey, when they move off of yield curve control, you might see a strengthening of the yen. And obviously that's not happened. In fact, we saw a weakening of the yen, as you just pointed out. So maybe you can kind of put it into this context a little bit, you know, what's happening with Japan's monetary policy and how that's affecting currency markets.
Yeah, no, Japan has been the vanguard at creative monetary policy for the last few decades as it struggled to get to positive inflation rates. They had zero interest rate policy, ZIRP. Then they had negative interest rate policy, NERP, yield curve control, as you mentioned, YCC. So lots of fun acronyms for people working in investment banks. And what's happened in the last few years is this reflation, helped by huge amounts of monetary and fiscal stimulus around the world, has fed through to Japan. Japan is seeing an economic recovery and a reflationary recovery where inflation has gotten above Japan's 2% inflation target for the first time in many, many years. And that's great news. And that reflation has led a lot of investors to get optimistic about Japanese stocks. You've actually seen Japanese stocks perform better than U.S. stocks in the last several months when you hedge out the currency impact, if you're talking about a dollar-based investor. So they've gotten into a good place in some respects. However, from a monetary policy perspective, they also have some pretty big challenges. So Japan, I think, as a lot of people know, are also at the forefront when it comes to developed markets' debt. They have about a debt-GDP ratio of about 260%. Now, for the last few decades, with inflation around zero, interest rates around zero, servicing that debt was not an issue. But as they recover and interest rates start to go higher, debt servicing costs quickly eat up a lot of their fiscal pie. And that means policymakers have less room left over in their budget for other priorities, things that are going to matter to voters. And so they have to be very thoughtful as they raise rates, not to create a problem with debt servicing costs. At the same time, they don't want to raise rates so much that it threatens this ongoing recovery. They don't want to shoot themselves in the foot. And they have done that a few times over the last few decades by tightening fiscal policy too quickly into recoveries. And so what we're seeing from the Ministry of Finance, and the Bank of Japan executes intervention on behalf of the Ministry of Finance. So the government actually calls the shots here, but they're moving very, very cautiously on monetary policy. And I think that's part of the reason they're going down the inflation path. And just one other little factoid here, which I think is really important, Clay. Everything at the end of the day is going to tie to politics. And in Japan's case, Prime Minister Kishida's cabinet is not popular. There was a poll out just a few days ago. Their disapproval rating was 69%. That's the highest it's been since Kishida was inaugurated in 2021. So the prime minister and his cabinet are saying, okay, my voters are telling me inflation is a problem, especially imported food costs. My corporations are telling me they're having a hard time managing foreign exchange volatility when they're trying to plan for revenue. What can I do to help them? Well, intervention is a very visible, high-profile tool in their toolkit they can use to show that they're trying to do something. Strengthening the yen at the margin helps bring down inflation pressure or slows inflation pressure, and it stabilizes the currency, which makes hedging for those corporations a little easier.
Okay. And that's a, you know, frankly, a very good reminder. Don't forget politics. And, you know, I rattled off a bunch of policy issues and I did forget politics. So thank you for that. And so let's jump from Japan to the other side of the ocean, to the United States. And I do that because Japan, in some respects, you made a really good point earlier, which is the dollar or the U.S. is the price maker on a lot of these issues. And we've seen the dollar has risen pretty significantly. And I mean, I listen to people all the time who told me that's not going to happen this year, and they've been wrong, frankly. And we've seen a big rise. Now, what type of impact is that having? Well, we've seen that it's having an impact on the Japanese yen, but it's probably having an impact on other countries as well. So, you know, the dollar increase or appreciation is starting to affect other economies.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I just looked this morning, again, we're on May 2nd as we're talking right now. If you look at the 31 most liquid currencies that are tracked by Bloomberg, of the 31, 30 have fallen against the dollar so far this year. The only currency that has not fallen against the dollar is the Mexican peso, which is up a whopping 0.2%. So this is a broad dollar move. This is about the United States more than anything else. And in terms of what other countries is it affecting, you know, it's not all bad. You know, if you look at Europe, for example, the weaker euro is supporting their exporters, making their exports more competitive overseas. And if you look at their stock markets, a lot of those export companies are outperforming the market. So there are winners and losers. It's not all losers, but we're focusing more on the countries getting pinched by the dollar today. And I'd say one country that I would focus on for this conversation is South Korea. South Korea is in a similar place to Japan right now in that it's trying to manage inflation that's being imported, if you will, with the weaker local currency. So the weaker local currency, meaning it takes more of those Korean won to buy that imported good. So prices are going up at home. That's not very popular. And they have a lot of corporations in Korea that depend on exports. They manage those FX revenues through hedging. And when currencies move slowly, you can adjust hedges. When currency volatility picks up and there's very quick moves, creates uncertainty. It's much harder for companies to manage that well. That can affect their underlying earnings. That can affect the local stock market. Doesn't help politicians. So Korea is definitely in a similar boat to Japan, and they are talking with Japan about coordinated intervention. That would be interesting if we see it. We actually got a joint statement from the United States, Korea, and Japan when they met in Washington in April, saying that they're all closely monitoring currency situation. That's all you're going to get from the U.S. We're not going to see the U.S. step in and intervene with them because at the end of the day, the strong dollar helps control inflation here in the United States, which helps the Fed meet its goal. So the U.S. isn't going to come to their aid, but Korea is getting hit. There's another way that currencies and countries are getting pinched by the strong dollar. And I think that's particularly true broadly across emerging markets in two ways. One is that while it's much better today than a decade ago, there are still a number of emerging markets that have sizable dollar-denominated debt. And that means that if the local currency weakens, they need more of those currencies to service the dollar-denominated debt. So that puts a burden on the local governments. The second issue is that when American investors are thinking where to put their money, or any investor, and they say, I can own a U.S. Treasury for 4-point-something%, that's pretty attractive. It's a deep market. There's rule of law. I feel safe there. Or can I get an even higher yield, a better overall return, buying an emerging market bond? Say Indonesia, the 10-year bond, government bond there gives me a yield over 5%, so more attractive than the U.S. But when U.S. yields go up, as they have done this year, you know, 2-year and 10-year government bond yields in the U.S. have risen some 65, 70 basis points so far this year, the opportunity cost of buying a less liquid, less well-known emerging market, it's just not as attractive. So capital stays in the U.S., and that makes it harder for the emerging markets. In Indonesia's case, foreigners have sold local Indonesian bonds for the last 4 months. Indonesia's responded by intervening to strengthen its currency, the rupiah, and they've actually raised interest rates to try to make that yield more attractive vis-a-vis, say, the U.S. Treasury. So they're fighting back, and it remains to be seen if what they've done is sufficient to bring capital back into their market. Again, at the end of the day, what these countries need is really from the U.S. They need a soft landing where inflation in the U.S. comes down enough that the Fed can start cutting rates, but the economy remains resilient enough that Americans continue to want to buy lots of goods from overseas and help these countries' exporters.
All right, you've raised a number of points, and you talked about Korea. So let me talk about even the bigger player in that part of the world, which is China. So in the past, the United States is, well, during the Trump administration, they actually said it. They accused China of being a manipulator of its currency. Other administrations have not gone that far, but they basically implied it. And so there's always been this question of, is China basically just going to use its currency to try to get competitive advantage? And of course, now China also competes with Japan, and Japan's currency is now depreciated a lot. We've just seen recently Secretary Yellen and others talking about the problem of overcapacity and China subsidizing exports as becoming a problem. So, I don't know, how do you see the yuan or the renminbi, whichever you want to call it, how do you see China's currency during this situation? And can it feed back in a political way, even if right now it hasn't at this point?
Yeah, you set me up very well here. So China is in such a different spot from most of the economies around the world right now. They have borderline deflation. The March consumer price index there rose 0.1% year on year. So they're barely out of deflation. So a weaker renminbi would actually help them. It could help them both as an inflationary force at the margin, and it also could help the policymakers meet their growth goal by making exports more competitive. So right now, China could use a weaker currency. The problem, as you said, is that not everyone else around the world likes what that means. So you're seeing in the United States, in places like Germany, increasing pushback against what's perceived to be subsidized flood of cheap Chinese goods, particularly electric vehicles, things in the green tech space. And so if you weaken the currency on top of that, I think the risk of even more pushback or retaliatory measures from these countries would rise. And I don't think China is looking for that. So I think they'd be reluctant for that reason. The other issue China's facing right now has to do with their consumer. And the consumer is about as depressed in China as can be. And largely because they don't know where to store or grow their wealth anymore. You know, for the past few decades, the Chinese stored and grew their wealth primarily in the housing market. But now that the housing bubble has burst and house values are going down, that doesn't feel like a safe place to go anymore. Bank deposit interest rates in China are very unattractive, so that's not going to help them much. They don't want to go there. banks started creating these structured products for wealth creation, but many of them have not worked as well as expected. So there's not confidence in that. You're actually seeing Chinese looking for anywhere to hide, including selling renminbi to buy gold. So if China were to, say tomorrow, weaken its currency by 1 or 2%, which is what they did in 2015, August 2015, they devalued by 2% against the dollar, which is not a huge move, but it was sudden and unexpected. And instead of creating a reflationary impulse, lifting growth, helping inflation, it got the opposite. It got worries about further devaluation of the currency. That created capital flight as frightened Chinese consumers looked for anywhere else to put their money, tried to get it out of the country. The renminbi weakened so much, China had to intervene to support the currency, and their reserves ran down quite a lot in just a few months. I think China is very cognizant of that capital flight risk today. And even though it wants to try to shore up consumer confidence, it's not going to do that through a weaker currency. So I think both because of the worries over export pushback from overseas and the consumer situation, China may let its currency modestly weaken alongside a broadly strong dollar, but it's not going to do anything beyond that. And even with currency weakness that comes with a strong dollar, I think it'll manage it carefully just to make sure it doesn't turn into anything more disruptive, similar to what we saw in 2015.
Excellent. That's a very good point. So I kind of want to, well, first of all, I want to let you go. And then secondly, how do you think the U.S., you mentioned earlier, you don't see the U.S. intervening here and kind of getting involved because, as you said, it would kind of, both the Biden administration as well as the Fed really would like to have inflation be fully under control, and intervening in the markets is to weaken the dollar is probably not exactly, that kind of goes the opposite way. But do you see any, do you see the U.S. trying to do anything more than right now just basically trying to be rhetorically supportive of what's happening?
I mean, behind the scenes, the Federal Reserve tries to be a very good global partner. And I know you know this from your days in government, coordinating with the Federal Reserve. Not that the Fed isn't independent, but you all would speak. And they have swap arrangements to provide liquidity to the other countries. During the pandemic, they started the FEMA repo facility again to make sure there was liquidity for other markets. There's a lot of conversations that happen constantly. So it's not that the U.S. ignores other countries at all. It's just that the U.S. at the end of the day has to set policy for the U.S. And if the U.S. economy is strong and stable, all else equal, that tends to be a good thing for other economies. But it does mean that these other countries have to deal with these periods like the one we're in now, where the dollar strengthens pretty quickly. Maybe Clay, to end, and I don't want to end on a dark note, but I think a cautionary note, everything we're talking about right now could change a lot with the U.S. election. I mentioned Japanese politics at the start of our conversation. U.S. politics could matter a lot this year. We know that campaigns include a lot of rhetoric that do not become reality. So I take everything I hear these days from both parties with a large grain of salt. At the same time, we are hearing former President Trump and his advisors at least discussing the possibility of a weaker dollar policy. It's not clear to me that that would be a net plus for the U.S. economy or the global economy. And I'm being diplomatic with my words here. But if we were to see Trump win, if this policy became reality, at a minimum, we'd be looking at a period of heightened uncertainty and volatility in financial markets. And then it would, depend, of course, on the conditions at the time and exactly how it's implemented. We just don't know any of that yet. But currencies are going to continue to be a big focus in the coming months, and potentially an even greater focus after November this year. So we'll have to talk again.
Well, thank you very much. And I would really look forward to that, particularly since I really begged you in the last week to do this, and because everything was happening so fast. So thank you so much again, Rebecca, for coming on and helping us understand this very complicated but a very interesting issue.
Happy to do it.
So now it's time for my 3-2-1. That's my three main takeaways from my conversation with Rebecca Patterson. Two things I'm looking forward to that are related, and my one sports fact. for my three takeaways. First, Japan has almost assuredly intervened in the markets in the past week to appreciate the yen because it had been falling so rapidly and it reached a 34-year low against the US dollar. Next, it's an important concept that we got to keep in mind. The exchange rate is important and it's what gets headlines, but it really is about what's happening in policy. And we heard about it in terms of what is usually referred to as interest rate differentials. In other words, the US interest rates are going up while Japan's are not. And so then you want to put more money into the thing that is priced better. And so that's where the dollar rises. But I thought that also, and Rebecca made a good point, which is we got to keep politics in mind here, including Japan's politics. And third, is the dollar's appreciation is having a greater impact on countries beyond Japan. Rebecca reminded us of some of the issues going on in South Korea and to a certain extent in China. Now, two things I'm looking forward to. The first is how do these interventions that Japan has taken work? We'll see over the following few days or weeks how the markets react. Rebecca made a very good point about sometimes interventions can be helpful in the short run, but still not very sustainable. Can this one be a little more sustainable and change the trajectory? And next, how does China react to all this? Do they take any measures in their currency? I think Rebecca, and I don't want to speak for her, kind of suggested that she didn't see that happening. But will China try to do something about this because of their own concerns about their economy and how the Japanese yen could be affecting them as well as the dollar affecting them? Now for my one sports fact. I'm turning to the National Basketball Association, that's the professional basketball league here in the United States, which is in the middle of their playoffs. An interesting factoid got sent to me the other day, which was since 2005, so that's 19 years ago, three people have always made it to the second round of the NBA playoffs. By the way, these are three of the greatest basketball players ever: LeBron James, Steph Curry, and Kevin Durant. This year, none of the three of them are actually even going to make the second round of the playoffs. And that's the first time that none of them will make it in 19 years. Now, these are three of the greatest players we've ever seen, as I mentioned. Among them, they have had seven MVP titles, most valuable player in the league. Among them, seven times they have been the NBA Finals MVP, and among them they have 10 NBA championships on their respective teams. But this season is clearly different. Last year when I talked about the NBA playoffs, I pointed out that the last five MVPs of the NBA were all international. And this year it appears that that will be the case again because the three top vote getters are Giannis Antetokounmpo, who's won it twice, and he's from Greece, Nikola Jokic, who is from Serbia, who has also won it twice, and a newcomer, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who's from Canada, plus, of course, we have last year's MVP, Joel Embiid, and somebody who a lot of people think is going to be a future MVP, which is Luka Doncic from Slovenia. But beyond the international side, the not seeing LeBron and Steph and KD in going forward in the playoffs means that maybe some other teams that have not had as much success are rising up. And we see good performances already early on from the Minnesota Timberwolves, who won their first series in 20 years, and the Oklahoma City Thunder, who have never won anything, even when Kevin Durant played on their team. So I think that this is a good transition point. We're seeing some of our greatest players leaving the game or not having as much success, and we're seeing teams that have had less success as well as having these great international players. Maybe the NBA is changing. We'll see going forward whether that's for the good or not. Well, that's going to wrap up this episode of Current Account. I again want to thank Rebecca Patterson for her appearance on the show today. And as always, we'd love to hear your feedback on the show as we constantly look to improve and enhance the experience for you, the listener. We can be reached at podcast@iif.com. All our episodes can be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.